This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, America, or whatever your time zone across this beautiful planet Earth of ours. You are tuned into the People Speak radio show with Steve Johnson. The People Speak show normally airs every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS radio network. Anyone can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. That number again, 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the government and politics section of Pal Talk, the largest free chat program in the world, where we have our virtual radio room called the People Speak Radio Show, that anyone may join to participate during the show. We have a very, very special guest on our show tonight. I'm more excited than a Bilderberger at Bohemian Grove, knee-deep in goat's blood. We're talking tonight to former U.S. Marine and outspoken professor James Fetzer about his two new books available from moonrockbooks.com. They are called I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either, and Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. Welcome to the show, Professor Fetzer, sir.
Oh, hey, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks very much for inviting me.
You know, I've been looking forward to this for a while now.
Good.
We'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, Professor, but my first question to you is, these books that you've written, they're a work in conjunction with Mike Palachek. Can you tell us what other contributors were involved in the printing of the books?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I just happen to have both of them right here. There are some really excellent contributors to the Moon book, which discusses not only evidence that we did not go to the moon. We have four chapters, 100 pages, by Nick Kullerstrom, who's a historian of science from the UK. He's also the leading expert on the 7/7 London bombing attacks. He has a book entitled Terror on the Tube, now in its third edition. He was the most inclined to be sympathetic to the idea we went. Sterling Harwood, who's both a professor at a college in California and also an attorney at law, who's been very good on and contributed to both books. Winston Wu, who has a wonderful article, 35 Proofs We Didn't Go to the Moon, wonderful stuff. And Jay Wiedner, who's well known on faking the moon landing and how it was done by Kubrick, filming it. That's a terrific piece. Then we have four chapters on what to me has been a surprisingly controversial issue and where I myself took a year and a half before I worked my way into understanding what was going on here, on whether Paul McCartney actually died, and it would appear to be, oddly enough, on 9/11 of 1966, and was replaced. And I had been in a long-standing exchange with someone who spoke at the conference I organized in Vancouver, a woman by the name of Claire Kuhn, who'd been long since convinced that this had happened. But it was only when I discovered the work of two Italian forensic scientists who demonstrated, they set out to disprove the hypothesis by comparing the individuals named or called Paul McCartney before and after that date, but they found that they were in fact different, that they are different in their skulls and their shape of their faces, they're different in their palates, they're different in their teeth, they're even different in their height. And that was terribly important to me because all my work is scientifically oriented. I am a professional philosopher of science. I earned my PhD in the history and the philosophy of science at Indiana in 1970 and then had a 35-year career offering courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning at a wide range of universities where I spent nearly 20 years, the last part of my career on the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota before I retired in 2006. But there's an article there by Sterling Harwood, again, the attorney and professor. Nick Kullerstrom, again, anonymous student here, is actually the forensic evidence because I was able to obtain a translation into English. And then James Larson, who's a fellow out in Hollywood who's done a tremendous amount of research on this, wrote an utterly fascinating essay about it. So that's another 100 pages. Then there are third part is about the first death of Saddam Hussein. I have had a long radio show with over 880 episodes called The Real Deal up until this year when it went video. And in those 880 episodes, I'd done interviews on a whole host of topics, and I was contacted by a woman by the name of Yvonne Wachter, who explained to me how the people didn't know, but Saddam Hussein was actually taken out on the 7th of April, 2003, just 3 weeks into the invasion of Iraq. And that Bush was going to announce that he'd been taken out on the mission accomplished ceremony on the USS Lincoln off of the coast of San Diego. But they realized belatedly, we think it was Donald Rumsfeld, that the three presidents had signed executive orders forbidding the assassination of the leader of a foreign state. So that if he were to announce it, he'd actually be explained that he would be identifying himself as having broken the law. They thought that would be too sensational, so they let it go. Actually, one of his doubles was found in a spider hole. And Joe Veals from Australia, who was a brilliant journalist, noticed there were differences in their teeth and in their bite, that the real Saddam had excellent teeth and an overbite, but the double, the replacement, whom they claimed to find in a spider hole, had bad teeth and an underbite. And I went about verifying what Joe had reported and got the ace of spades from the deck of cards that the U.S. command in Iraq was using to identify all the principal players, and found he was exactly right. I verified it on multiple ways. And Yvonne knew about this because it was her son, Captain Chris Wachter, who actually had piloted the B-1 bomber that had done the run on a restaurant on the outskirts of Baghdad and taken out not only Saddam, but his two sons and 50 or 60 members of general staff. Huge, huge story. I published a couple articles about it in Veterans Today when I was a journalist there. I even called Ed Schultz and got him right before a lunchtime break and started to spell out the story. And he said, "This was fantastic. Stand by. We'll get the rest of the story." And then he kept me hanging on the phone, on my cell phone, for an hour and a half and never came back to me. So I haven't published an article about how Ed Schultz had left me hanging. Then there's also two chapters about the second death of Osama bin Laden, because the raid on the compound in 2011 was a purely political stunt. Osama bin Laden had actually died on or about 15 December 2001 in Afghanistan from his medical maladies. It's tough to get those dialysis machines in and out of those caves in Afghanistan. There were local obituaries at the time. He was buried in an unmarked grave. David Ray Griffin has published a book about it, Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive. Nick Kullerstrom, same guy, published an article entitled Osama bin Laden, 1957 to 2001. Osama was our man in Afghanistan. People don't understand. He was Colonel Tim Osman in the CIA. So, you know, the idea of demonizing him for 9/11 was simply absurd. But there it is. Interestingly, although we often think Fox News isn't, you know, is more propaganda or entertainment than news, they actually published a story. Osama bin Laden reported dead on 26 December of 2001, which you can still find online. I thought it was so important, I made a copy of it and put it in the book. Then we have, the final four chapters are about the Holocaust. Now, this, of course, is the most controversial, but I became interested when I was invited to participate in a conference on academic freedom, Are There Limits to Inquiry, JFK, 9/11, and the Holocaust, which were examples we were discussing. You know, are these forbidden subjects in the academic institutions? And I'd done so much work on JFK and 9/11, where I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005, just 6 months before my retirement after that 35-year career, that I thought it would be interesting for me to dig in about the Holocaust. And in fact, Nick Holerstrom had published a new book about it entitled Breaking the Spell. That's quite brilliant. And, you know, among the points I was making that are reported in the book is that there are 236 references to 6 million Jews in dire straits or fear of loss of their life before the Nuremberg Tribunal and beginning as early as 1890. So we know that that number, 6 million, isn't empirically or scientifically based. In fact, it turns out to be derived from a disputed passage in Leviticus that's been interpreted as meaning that the chosen people can only return to the promised land when there are minus 6 million who have been consumed in the flames. But since there was no word for 6 million in the original Hebrew, it requires interpolation. In addition, there's scientific research, relatively recent, determining that if the bodies had, you know, died from cyanide poisoning, Zyklon B being a form of cyanide, they would have turned pink, and that the walls of chambers where cyanide was used would turn blue, but the only chambers that turned blue were those that were used for delousing, where Zyklon B actually was being used to delouse the inmates because they wanted to keep them healthy, free from dysentery, typhus, and the like, because these were work camps. These were labor camps. These were not centers for extermination. So that I brought together three world-class experts on the Holocaust. Thomas Dalton, who published a book, The Holocaust Debate, quite brilliant. Robert Forresson, who's just sensational, and who explained that the Nuremberg tribunals were conducted to divert responsibility for the massive deaths of Germans that occurred from the Allied bombing of German cities, which was itself a war crime, onto the Germans, where the Allies had actually interdicted the railroad tracks that led to the camps, so that there was a lot of starvation in the camps at the end of the war because the Germans were unable to resupply the camps because the Allies had bombed the railroad lines, so that, you know, this brilliant article by Robert Forresson is in the book. And then Nick Holerstrom has another chapter where he talks about that more recent scientific research to which I alluded. So that's an intro to the Moon book. I found so much fascinating stuff. For example, that more Catholics than Jews died at Auschwitz.
The
International Committee of the Red Cross actually updated their numbers. They were going to all these camps and keeping very meticulous records about who died and their cause of death. And they revised them in 1993, and their final report was 297,081, far removed from 6 million. And where I was so intrigued by some of the photographs in Nick's book, I put one on the back cover of the book, namely of the British football team at Auschwitz, with a statement, what, you didn't know there was a UK soccer team at Auschwitz? And these people are all, you know, very healthy, vigorous. In fact, I included a map of Auschwitz where you find all kinds of features you might not have supposed would be there. They had a symphony hall, for example. They had a hospital with OBGY. They had, you know, other facilities for woodworking shop. They even had a brothel. They had a brothel at Auschwitz, believe it or not. So,
wow. You're kidding me, right? I could see Colonel Klink going to order one of the ladies. That doesn't seem right.
Colonel Klink, yeah. Well, I'll just tell you, I mean, this is a serious book, and there's a lot of great stuff in it. And remarkably enough, Amazon has not banned the Moon book. You would think if they were going to be upset about something. But of 20 books, they had 20 books on Sandy Hook, but only one of those books took the position that the government was wrong and demonstrated that it was untrue that anyone had died at Sandy Hook. And, of course, that's the title, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, a book that has 13...
Go ahead. Before we get on to the Sandy Hook book, I just want to clarify a few things about the first book, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. Now, you mentioned Robert Forresson. Is it not true that in a French court they actually found that they ruled, in fact, that the entire propaganda about the Holocaust was nothing more than Western war propaganda at the end of the war? Is that not true?
Well, you know, that may be true. I'm not an expert on Forresson's history. I do know that when there was a trial of Ernst Zundel, who had, explained that the Holocaust had all been an exaggeration for political purposes to benefit the Zionist cause. When he was taken to trial in 1984 and 1986, as I recall, they could not produce a single witness to testify that Jews had been put to death using gas in special chambers in any of these camps.
Not a single witness. I mentioned that because the late, great Anthony Lawson put out a video called A Great Man, Robert Farsam, that showed straight after the court trial the French court were actually ruling that the Holocaust was pure Western propaganda, and that video is still up online today. So
I think that's very good. Anthony and I had a falling out over an issue related to 9/11, which you may or may not want to discuss, about whether real planes had actually crashed or been used on 9/11. That's a very interesting issue. But Anthony had a tremendous, and it took me a year and a half of constant badgering from Morgan Reynolds and Judy Wood before I, as the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, could bring myself to look at the evidence, because I thought the whole idea was so preposterous. And now, today, I'm probably one of the world's leading advocates of what's known as no planes theory, which really is the conjunction of four propositions, namely that Flight 11 did not hit the North Tower, that Flight 77 did not crash into the Pentagon, that Flight 93 did not crash into Shanksville, and that Flight 175 did not hit the South Tower. And people think, well, isn't that absurd? Because don't we have videos? But the problem is the videos appear to be fraudulent. There are three different ways it could be fraudulent. The analysis that explains it, because they're actually violating the laws of physics. If you look at 175, the way it effortlessly enters the South Tower, there should have been a collision. There should have been an impact. The plane should have crumpled against the wall, the facade. It was an intricate steel and concrete structure, massive, 500,000 tons. It was intersecting eight different floors, each floor of which consisted of a steel truss filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete. So at 208 feet on the side, you had eight different floors, each of which had an acre of concrete on a steel truss connected to the core columns on the inside and the external steel support columns on the out, which were massive enough all by themselves. I published a whole lot about this now. But Anthony wanted to insist that they were special planes. He talked about the wings being coated with depleted uranium and all this. Well, it was a fantasy. I mean, Anthony did so much good work, but depleted uranium is one of the densest materials known to man, and it would completely alter the aerodynamics. You'd have to redesign, and it's a preposterous idea anyway, but Anthony was kind of infatuated with that sort of idea. No real plane could have effortlessly entered the North or the South Tower. It was a physical impossibility, and that's why they had to resort to faking it, which was done in a very sophisticated manner. But this may be something we want to defer for later conversation. I'll just tell you, I have no doubt about it. The best work on this has been done by a fellow in England by the name of Richard Hall with his Flight 175 3D radar analysis, and I can go through it in detail. But Anthony did a lot of great work. His This Is an Orange, for example, is simply brilliant. And he did, of course, the voice for the Towers of Dust. That was also a brilliant piece. But on the no planes theory, he and I clashed, so that he wound up, denouncing me to the end of his days.
Goodness me. Are you aware of Web Ferry's work and people like Nick
O'Howe? Yeah, sure. Web Ferry, absolutely. I was perhaps the first person to put Web Ferry on the air. I put her on my radio show, The Real Deal. You can find the interview at radiofetzer.blogspot.com.
Wow.
I was the first person, to the best of my knowledge, to interview Judy Wood, too. And that was on the 11th of November of 2006. And Steve Jones, Kevin Ryan, and those people were so upset that I wanted to broaden the range of theories under consideration, because I was already convinced that nanothermite could not have done it. Nanothermite is an incendiary. It has brilliant light, very high temperatures. It's been used historically to weld railroad tracks together or to disable artillery shells. You drop a thermite grenade down the barrel of a howitzer and it fuses the mechanism, so it's a useless weapon. but it doesn't have the rapid gas expansion properties of explosives and could not have been responsible for blowing apart the Twin Towers. And I have pressed them on that repeatedly. I co-authored three articles about nanothermite with T. Mark Hightower, who's a chemical engineer. And these were years ago, but they still want to pretend that nanothermite could have done the job. And when they allude to, well, it could have been combined with explosives to be explosive, I point out the same is true of toothpaste. It could be combined with explosives to be explosives. I do, however, think that thermite or nanothermite played a role in cutting out the images of the planes on the sides of the buildings, which I believe was actually set up by the Gelatin Group, these Israeli art students who were occupying the locations at the top of the towers and doing external, what they call performance art outside of the buildings. It was absolutely fascinating stuff. And, you know, Rebecca Roth, whom I have managed with the collaboration of others to expose as a fraud, did a lot of good work in her books, Methodical Illusion and Methodical Deception. It's just that she wasn't an airline attendant for 30 years. She actually had a long career in the natural oils business. She had a co-worker there where the name she used there was Monica Gaynor, that was named Michael on her more recent show, from which she was removed today or yesterday, actually, because of all of this.
She no longer has a program there?
Right. She was just removed because of what I'm telling you. And she had a co-worker on there named Ramjet. And not only did we have an audio tape that showed that Monica and Rebecca were the same person, I mean, it's that same distinctive voice, those same verbal gestures, the same laugh, the same coquettish style. But even Ramjet turns out to be the same as Michael on her new, the new show is Ramjet. The old show was Michael, but it's the same guy. He appears to have been the publisher of her two books. And also, I'm fairly convinced they're married, in fact. But there's been a lot of research on this. In fact, Pete Santilli has just released a study about this. He was on the same network, and he went back and did research on Rebecca and discovered her actual name was Sarah, S-A-R-A. It's not even Rebecca or Monica, but Sarah. So, you know, there's more coming out about this. It's a really fascinating story because so much in the 9/11 movement swooned over what they were learning from Rebecca in Methodical Illusion and Methodical Deception. I had published three blogs about her. One was entitled Rebecca Roth's Methodical Illusion, Pros and Cons, where I specifically commented favorably about her identification of the role of Israel in all of this and of the Gelatin Group. But I have a friend who was the top Navy troubleshooter in electronics before he left the Navy to join Raytheon by the name of Dennis Camino. And Dennis had spent 6 hours talking to Rebecca in an evident effort by Rebecca to recruit some technical experts to support her work. But after the 6 hours, he was convinced that Rebecca was a fraud, in part because she had told him that by shutting off the transponder, the plane would no longer be visible to radar, which is a kind of confusion that no one in the business would ever make because the transponder sends out an identification signal. But radar sends out radio waves that bounce off of objects in the air and reflect back, and shutting off the transponder would not cause those radio waves to not bounce back off of a plane in the air. So she sent Dennis an inscribed copy of her book. I've got it in my hand as I speak. And it says, Dennis, keep the truth alive. Fasten your seatbelt, Rebecca Roth. Because he didn't even want to open it. She had called him and he traced her phone number back to Langley, and that made him very suspicious. Dennis knows a lot about the spook business, and he was already convinced. So when I did this very first blog about Rebecca, I did talk about the pros and the cons, just as I'm doing with you now. Then I got deeper into this, and it looked more and more fishy, and I published a second entitled Rebecca's Methodical Illusion May Be Rebecca Herself. And then a fellow by the name of Alan Powell, who's from Australia and done some brilliant work on Sandy Hook. He was responsible for two of the chapters, 7 and 8, that I'll talk about, each of which has 50 photographs, 50 in the chapter 7 of them furnishing the Lanza home to serve as a prop, and then 50 of them refurbishing the school to serve as the stage.
Before we get on to Sandy Hook, I want to complete this Rebecca Roth story. Has there been any evidence whatsoever that she had a 30-year airline experience as an employee at all?
It appears to be completely fabricated. So that Alan published this third blog, which is entitled A Fiction Writing Fiction About a Fiction. You know, that's so odd in the first place she'd be putting this information out in the form of a novel. But it gives her plausible deniability. You know, if anyone attacked her for having something wrong, she could always say, well, it was just a novel. But the fact of the matter is, she does not appear to have actually had that history as a stewardess. That appears to be a fabrication.
So I could put out a book about 9/11 saying that I was a pilot if I come up with my own nickname and put on a wig and glasses? Is that the same thing?
Yeah, that's a par. Except, you know, the fact that she's got this connection to Langley, she also does a lot of praise of Steve Jones and architects and engineers, and I've already explained to you why there are problems with them about the nanothermite. So she's, in essence, trying to reinforce or revive architects and engineers, which has gone so far as in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. And when Steve first created it, I told him, because of my extensive editorial background, that the key to the journal was the editorial board. He had to have an impeccable group of editors and not simply appoint cronies and friends, but he appointed cronies and friends so that there are articles on in the Journal of 9/11 Studies that maintain that the Pentagon was actually hit by a Boeing 757. Now, I have published at least a half a dozen articles demonstrating that's false. Dennis, who knows so much about flight, did a brilliant job of a photographic portfolio about the Pentagon. Believe me, the evidence that no plane hit the Pentagon is overwhelming. And I can send you a link, you know, a list of articles. Interestingly, I had 150 articles on Veterans Today about all these subjects, Sandy Hook, Boston bombing, 9/11, JFK, more, from 2011, when Gordon Duff first invited me to become a journalist there, until earlier this year, when he canned me because I was writing about Jade Helm. Gordon had been severely critical of another journalist for Veterans Today writing about Jade Helm. I thought that was all wrong. So I published an article explaining why Gordon was wrong and Jade Helm was not an ordinary training drill. And the next day he sacked me from Veterans Today. I noticed weeks later he still had my name on the masthead as though I were still there. And I said, Gordon, isn't it time to take it off? You know, he took off my name. He deleted all 150 of my articles. But that apparently had such an impact on the readers of Veterans Today, who they may have lost as much as 50% of their readership, that the editorial board about 6 weeks later voted to have them restored. And eventually, there's a little song and dance that went along with that, too. But they have been restored. Once I discovered they were up, I transferred 70 of the 150 to my blog. So if you go to October 28, 29, 30... you're going to find I've got 30 or 40 articles in each of those days because I was transferring them like mad, getting my best JFK stuff and 9/11 stuff out of Veterans Today onto my own blog.
Okay, Professor Fetzer, what circumstances surrounding the initial concepts for writing the two books that you have? First of all, and we didn't go to the moon either. What was the initial concept that gave birth to that book?
Well, what's interesting about that is the first book was supposed to be Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. So, you know, so an obvious response to that would be, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, because everyone believes, you know, the story we've been told about Sandy Hook. This came from the fertile imagination of Mike Palachek, who's an absolutely wonderful guy who had the inspiration for the series Resist the Empire, Save the World, in which these books are volumes. And it was his idea that we should do these books. But then because of my editorial experience, it fell to me to edit them, to actually get them done. So Mike was the creative mind behind the whole series, and there are going to be other books. I mean, I'm in the process of completing the third, which will be about the Boston bombing. And I just hope the American people will catch on, that we are taking these apart so thoroughly, so systematically, that in the case of the Sandy Hook book, the Amazon decided it had to ban, which I'm sure was a consequence of political pressure. Jay Carney, who had been the White House press secretary, had left the White House to go to Amazon.com as senior vice president. The Sandy Hook had been used as the fulcrum of the Obama gun control agenda. They expected to get, 26 lobbyists with anti-gun lobbyists with impeccable credentials because they'd lost children or loved ones at Sandy Hook. And, this book was demonstrating there was a complete fraud. So, there it is. And I even have an appendix in there showing that when you ban guns, crime goes up, for the obvious reason that you're taking guns away from law-abiding citizens, and that means it's the criminals who have the guns. It turns out that there's a 20-minute delay between a 911 call to the police in an emergency and their actual arrival, but most of the mayhem occurs in the first 5 minutes. So that if you don't have weapons yourself, you can't count on the police to arrive in time. Your daughter may have been raped, your wife mugged, you may have been killed. In fact, when we're on the verge of war, it's absolutely fantastic to promote gun control because, if Russia and the U.S. come to blows, and there are many in the Obama administration who are seeking to promote precisely that outcome, Washington and New York are going to be taken out immediately. That means we're going to be living in a post-nuclear Jericho world, as the series, short-lived film TV series, demonstrated. If you don't have weapons to arm yourself, you're going to be subject to the rape, robbery, mayhem by marauding gangs.
Subject to fascism.
Yeah, that's right. So, Obama has got it 100% wrong. In fact, the European countries now, Germany, for example, they're going crazy over guns because of this influx of Muslims. Sweden has become the rape capital of the universe because there are all these thuggish immigrants who are completely uncivilized, and they're just raping women right and left. I mean, it's complete outrage.
Well, we'll stick with us, Mr. Fetzer, sir. This is the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson. We're live on radio, internet radio, coming to you live across the world, and we'll be right back with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to the People Speak Radio Show on the BBS Radio Network online, coming to you live across America and across the beautiful planet Earth, either in live stream, podcast, or on video. No matter whether you're on the globe or on the flat Earth or maybe in another astral plane, wherever you are, you're tuned in and you're listening. God bless you. I'm your host for this beautiful evening, and we're back with our guest tonight. He's a former U.S. Marine and a researcher of false flags. His website is www.jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. Do check it out. Welcome back there, Professor Fetzer, sir.
Oh, great. I'm glad to be back. And perhaps I should add that the banning was quite a blunder, because instead of selling, 8,000 or 10,000 copies of the book, I immediately released it to the public for free as a PDF. So that we're getting millions of downloads of the PDF. So I think that, you know, this they thought they were being clever, but it seems to have backfired. And now we have found a new printer and publisher, new printer and distributor at moonrockbooks.com. So you can now get both of these volumes in bound editions, but also have the benefit of the color photographs and the PDF that's available for free, because in order to keep the price down, we printed all the pictures in the book in black and white.
And we'll certainly be giving the people in the chat room and the people online and the people watching this video, we'll be giving them the link to download that if they so wish to. And, of course, the link to buy the book from moonrocksbooks.com, which I would recommend to support your work and get some more books written on these types of subjects.
Yes, yes, yes. Have you put out a number for people to call in, or is it done a different way?
Yes, sir. People can call in, but we have got some questions here from the guests. We have a question from Winston Smith in Hawaii, who says, Professor Jim, could you please tell us who reported to you that the 1 terabyte worth of FOIA records were stolen by Rebecca Roth, and how did she accomplish this?
Well, actually, that's one of those cases where you have sources that you don't want to put on the spot. I mean, I'm an investigative journalist, and it's well known. You know, these are people who had been taken for a ride by Rebecca and did their own research and discovered this fellow had this huge amount of work he'd done, and that Rebecca commandeered it. But, I mean, you know, I think Rebecca is toast. I think you can stick a fork in her. She's done.
We have a question from Suicide Blonde in Arkansas, talking about the No Plane theory. Professor Fetzer, sir, don't you believe that these things were drones, that they could not have possibly been any kind of commercial airplane at all?
Well, that was the original plan. I have no doubt that Dov Zakheim, you know, was the controller of the Pentagon when it went missing the $2.3 trillion, had a company with remote control systems. So that was the original plan. And I think it was only when they discovered that it was physically impossible to get a real plane all the way into the building before it exploded that they had to abandon that approach. So, I mean, it's very plausible, except that it violates the laws of physics. You would have had, you know, equal and opposite force. People like to talk about how fast the plane was flying, which pilots have determined was faster than was in fact aerodynamically possible for a 767 at that altitude. But they don't talk about the enormous horizontal resistance posed by these massive 500,000-ton buildings. And as I mentioned, in this instance, the South Tower, Flight 175, was intersecting with 8 different floors with the steel trusses filled with, you know, an acre of concrete apiece. We know what happens to a commercial carrier when it encounters a tiny bird weighing a few ounces in flight. Well, imagine encountering an acre of concrete on a steel truss. It was not physically possible. They would have crumpled up against the building, the wings, tail, bodies, seats, luggage fall into the ground, the engines would have entered. But in fact, we know that an engine found at Church and Murray was actually planted there. It was an antiquated engine, an old engine, not currently in service. It was underneath a steel scaffolding just sitting on the sidewalk. And Jack White, who was a legendary photo and film analyst with whom I did years of collaborative research on JFK, also became interested in 9/11 and discovered Fox News footage. There's Fox on the job again, of a white van where there's a group of maybe as many as 5 men in FBI vests unloading something heavy. They were clearly delivering the engine to be a plant at the intersection of Church and Murphy, and subsequently a landing gear was found wedged between 2 buildings, but it had a piece of rope attached to it that had been used to lower it into place.
Wow, very interesting stuff. I hadn't heard about that, We have John from Ontario on line one. Are you there, John?
I'm here.
Go ahead, sir, with your question. And Professor Fetzer, are you ready?
Sure, go ahead.
Hi, Professor. I want to preface my question with this. First of all, I believe that there are many false flags that have been perpetrated on us. I'm not arguing that point at all. And secondly, I think we are right to question everything and anything. So I don't disregard a lot of what you're saying. But with respect to Sandy Hook, I wanted to ask you this question. There's a school board that is in charge of that Sandy Hook school, correct?
Yeah, sure.
How many people work at that school board?
Well, Wolfgang Helbig and I went to Newtown so we could meet with the school board and confront them with our research. You're not appreciating that the school was closed by 2008. Everyone knew it was closed. All the parents were crisis active.
Right, so here's my question.
Look, they were all in
on it. I want to know
how
you get an entire school board to be complicit with a false flag operation like that. Can you explain that?
Sure. They thought they were doing good. They thought that we have a need for more gun control. Eric Holder was a fanatic on the subject. He actually had stated to a Democratic Women's National Conference in 1995 that we need to brainwash the American people to change their attitude about guns. Sandy Hook was a very cleverly contrived hoax, many years in the planning to accomplish precisely that purpose. The school board had an abandoned school that was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards. When I got up there and had my 3 minutes to speak to the school board, I asked them, when were the parents notified that their children were attending school in a toxic waste dump? If you look at the massive evidence we have put together proving that the school was closed, and I recommend you go to my blog. Just do this, do a search on the following title, Debunking the Sandy Hook Debunkers, number one, was it an operating school? You will discover it was not an operating school. We prove it dozens of different ways.
I'm asking you about that.
Huh?
I'm asking you, do you think it's reasonable to think that everybody in a school board would be complicit with this? To a name?
Well, I don't like a coulda, woulda, shoulda arguments. I mean, this is a fact of what happened. There's no doubt about it.
How many members of the school board are there?
I don't know, a dozen or more. The whole community, for God's sake, you're not understanding. The whole community was in on it. The governor was in on it.
My local school board.
The Connecticut State Police.
Has over 400 people in it.
We need to get another caller because he's not going to look at the evidence. He's got a preconception, and it's frankly stupid because when you have evidence that shows something happened.
Every school board member bought into this conspiracy. Is that right?
Yeah, and they wound up getting $50 million for a new school when the average cost of a kindergarten through fourth grade school is only $7 million. I looked into it. You haven't. For God's sake, we got a free book out there. Read it. You don't understand how stupid your question is.
So Professor, here's the thing. You've got these people in charge of our children, and you're telling me that they would be this complicit and this underhanded to the American people? And they're in charge of our children?
I'm not just telling you. We have proven it. We have proven it. 425 pages of proof. Let's go to another.
But you don't know how many people work at the school board.
This is a waste of time. This is a waste of time.
I do hear you, Professor Fetzer. And you know what? I believe he hasn't heard of Mr. David Wheeler. And David Wheeler was one of the fathers of the so-called victims of Noah. And apparently, he actually turned up in FBI outfit. He actually turned up in an FBI outfit on the day of Sandy Hook.
Yeah.
And then went on to present as a family member. And indeed, he actually turns out he was a stooge. He was an actor, crisis actor, that
turns
out to be nobody in particular.
He was walking up and down Dickinson Drive in a military style, carrying a weapon, and he was also playing the role of a grieving father. And his wife, Francine, was even featured by Obama in the White House
The only other person who have given a talk out of the Oval Office, apart from Obama, is Joe Biden and Francine Wheeler on behalf of gun control. Obama was in on it. Eric Holder was in on it. The governor of the state was in on it. The Connecticut State Police were in on it. It's so elaborate. And I understand why this guy has difficulty imagining he wouldn't do something like that. But unfortunately, this is exactly what happened at Sandy Hook. And for him to come on and be hysterical when I'm explaining where he can find the proof, trading on coulda, woulda, shoulda, you know, gee, he can't imagine how they could have done it. Well, man up, they did it.
Well, you know, sir, this is the People Speak radio show, and we get questions from everybody. And,
yeah,
and that's what I love
I take
about
it. He took over 8.5 minutes with a question that I'd already answered, but which he hasn't researched, you know. I mean, you can come people who have hardcore beliefs that they're not going to change regardless of the evidence. There's a mountain of evidence. I've even told them where to go.
We do have a question from Majid from Canada. What about the people who appeared on the media talking about their lost ones in Sandy Hook? They're easy to track. Did you track them down and talk to them or find out about their loved ones?
This is really unbelievable. Sure. I mean, I had published 30 articles on Sandy Hook before we did the book. Some of the most blatant cases were, for example, Robbie Parker, who claims to have lost his daughter, Emily, the day after, comes out of the building. He's all jocular, laughing, jovial. All of a sudden, he sees the press. He stops and hyperventilates to get into character and proceeds to talk about the loss of his daughter, but doesn't forget to mention the donation sites. You know, we didn't really go through Sandy Hook because I spent so much time on the Moon book, but we have discovered the FEMA manual. It was a 2-day drill. It had a rehearsal on the 13th, going live on the 14th. That's why you had the sign, everyone must check in. That's why you had boxes of bottled water and pizza cartons at the firehouse. That's why there were so many there with name tags on lanyards. That's why there were porta potties already in place. That's why parents were even bringing children to the scene. Does anyone seriously believe a parent would bring a child to the scene of a child shooting massacre? And so
absolutely
many of
not.
Them didn't understand the difference between the rehearsal and going live the following day, so that many donation websites for the survivors were put up on the 13th. Even Adam Lanza was recorded in the Social Security Death Index as having died on the 13th. I mean, there's a mountain of this. It's all in the book. I mean, I've given it to you for free. I suggest you download it and read it. If you got questions about Sandy Hook, it's going to be hard for me to imagine what question isn't answered there.
Yes, sir. We have a question from Jane Goubels in New Jersey. Every 5 years, we seem to get a new Holocaust movie. Professor Fetzer, are we not just about due for a new one?
I'm sorry. I missed the key word there.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Jingle Bells in New Jersey asks a question. Every 5 years, we seem to get a new Holocaust movie. Are we not just due for a new one?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, you know, Hollywood is dominated by persons who want to support the Hollywood mythology. I mean, you got these great movies, Schindler's List, you know, the piano, Sophie's Choice and all this, and they're very touching. They're just a false narrative. These were not extermination centers, and 6 million Jews were not put roast to death or put gas to death in and then cremated in the ovens. People have made calculations how long it would take given the amount of time and energy it requires to cremate a human body. And I think if you were doing 6 million, we'd probably still be cremating them today.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, Professor Fetzer, sir, is the word Holocaust is actually a Jewish and Hebrew word, which means a burnt offering. It means a sacrifice that is offered by them to get something in return from Jehovah.
Yes.
People just don't get? That's their own sacrifice of their own people, of their own livestock, to their God to get whatever blessings that they're getting from that particular sacrifice.
Not to make an obvious point, but the leading practitioners of false flag attack in the world are the Israelis. They dressed up a gang of Ergun terrorists to bomb the King David Hotel back in 1946 to drive the British out of Palestine. They attacked the USS Liberty in 1967 to try to draw the U.S. into the war against Egypt. They didn't really need us. Lyndon Johnson was complicit in that. In 1992 and 94, they attacked their own embassy in Buenos Aires to retaliate against Argentina's cooperation with Iran and the peaceful development of nuclear energy. They first attacked their own embassy in 1992, where about two dozen died. They claimed it was a car bomb, but the building blew up from the inside out. And when that didn't garner enough attention, they did it again on their Jewish community center in 1994, again claiming a car bomb. In that case, it was about 84 people who died. I published about all these things. There's an article entitled False Flag Attacks in Argentina, 1992 and 1994 on VoltaireNet.org with Adrian Salbucci from Argentina. And of course, 9/11 was brought to us by the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, half of whom were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens and the Mossad. So we can go through all of this. It's just there's a huge history here. And, nothing to be... That's why on 9/11, some of you may recall, between the destruction of the South Tower and the North, and the South Tower only had these very modest fires for about an hour, before it collapsed, whereas Underwriters Laboratory had certified the steel used in the building to 2,000 degrees for 3 or 4 hours without suffering any adverse effects, and where when NIST studied 236 samples of steel from the buildings, they found 233 had not been exposed to temperatures above 500 degrees Fahrenheit, the other three not above 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit, which means that these fires lasted, burnt neither hot enough nor long enough to cause any damage to the steel. And where in the North Tower, the fires only endured for an hour and a half. But in between, they ran footage of Palestinians rejoicing. And it was given, it was there, they had it right at hand to convey the impression that Palestinians were happy about what happened on 9/11. It turned out to be archival footage of distant, years earlier, where something religious or political event had called Palestinians to rejoice. But that gives you a signal as to who was behind 9/11. In fact, they even reported on national television that the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine was taking responsibility, which is so absurd, I can't begin to tell you. It had nothing to do with 19 Islamic terrorists, and Osama bin Laden was our man in Afghanistan, as I've already explained. This was poppycock, and the Americans have been just sold. They have been bamboozled over 9/11. It's a complete outrage.
And that is, in fact, one of the headlines of one of your articles at Veterans Today that caught my interest about your research. Have we been bamboozled?
Yeah. That was originally published by a Canadian journal. It's a real nice little article just talking about, four different issues, and two of them it's had
fantastic.
To do.
Fantastic. I recommend everybody to search that term.
Yeah. Well, most of my articles are longer. I like to embed lots of evidence, photographs, diagrams, documents, and give lots of sources. So that was atypical because it was one of my shorter articles, but it was very popular.
I do have a question here from Jane Bond in New Hampshire asking, Professor Fetzer, sir, have you heard that all new FBI agents have to tour the Holocaust Museum as part of their induction?
I think I have heard that. And how ridiculous can you get? I mean, this just demonstrates the exorbitant, really excessive influence that Israel has over the United States. I mean, JFK actually had the World Jewish Congress registered as a foreign agent. He would have done the same with AIPAC. No president since has had the courage and integrity to demand that happen. AIPAC is by far the most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C. I've heard absurd rebuttals such as, how could a little country geographically like Israel control a big country like the United States? It's got nothing to do with the relative size of the geography of the countries. Israel has for too long exercised grossly disproportionate influence over the United States Senate, some members of whom ought to openly declare themselves to be senators from Israel.
Well, Professor Fetzer, sir, the current president of the United States won a Nobel Prize just a few years ago. Is this not a sure sign that our system is rigged to glorify war criminals?
It was an absurdity. Barack Obama has sent military forces into 17 different nations in Africa alone.
Afghanistan is the longest war in which the United States has ever engaged, and we're there primarily to protect the poppy crops so the CIA can harvest them because they make so much money, from the drug trade. They got hooked on cocaine in Southeast Asia. Now they want to perpetuate the drug wars. That's why the war on drugs perseveres to keep the price high so the CIA can cash in. It's got nothing to do. Marijuana is relatively innocuous. It should never have been made illegal just because a generation prefers to smoke its high rather than drink it. They have spent endless amounts of money on an investigation prosecution for the harmless crime of smoking joints. That's completely ridiculous. You take working men and women who are producing taxes, put them into prisons. We have to then pay for them. It probably runs about $100,000 to keep an individual incarcerated in prison per year. For smoking joints, that's completely absurd. It's beyond belief, but the war on drug continues to this day.
Yes, yes. Well, we're running out of time here, Professor Fetzer. Sir, stick with us, please, by all means. And I'll show you how to get on Pal Talk so we can do some questions and answers live in the chat room a little bit
super,
after.
Super, super. If you can get me in there, we're good to go. I'll stay.
Please do. One last question. Do you support the stop funding of Israel?
Yes, I certainly do. Israel has been, it's not even legal for Israel to be receiving funding from the United States because they have undeclared massive stockpile of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, and our foreign policy guidelines preclude giving any foreign aid to a country with undeclared nuclear weapons. So Israel, wow, frankly, is not entitled to any foreign aid from the United States if we were only to adhere to our own guidelines, in that we are not, is another indication of their pernicious influence over the United States government.
Would you not see that Israel is actually occupied Palestine after all?
Oh, actually, that's a very fascinating question, because recent DNA studies have shown that the occupants of Israel are not descended of the tribe of Judea. They come from the Ukraine, the Khazarian region, or Europe, which means that since the identification of Semites is a linguistic one and all the Arabs are Semites, Israel turns out to be the greatest practitioner of anti-Semitism in the world.
Absolutely. Well, fantastic. Thank you very much for your answers and questions. We're going to have to get you on here again on the BBS Radio Network because
Gladly. Everybody
loved you. The room has never been so full.
Gladly.
Fantastic. Thank you, sir. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Professor Jim Fetzer, sir.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Wonderful. Join us coming up soon on the People Speak show when I talk with Geroid Colmain, the reporter, Alish D'Avalon, an Australian researcher, and Professor Ian Plimer. Stay tuned for those interviews coming soon. Big thanks go out to the producers, Mike, Doug, and Donald, to all my friends throughout the world, and to all the guys who give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel. But for me for now, take care and bye until next time. And of course, hope you enjoyed this one just as much as I did. Bye for now.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land.